Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of It's About Time, a DC sports podcast. It is February 6th, 2019, the evening of. Apologize for being a few days late this week. Been a lot going on. And I was honestly waiting for some news to drop baseball-wise. I really thought as we get under 10 days, we're now 7 days away from pitchers and catchers reporting. There are a lot of free agents out there, not just Bryson Manny and Dallas Keuchel and Craig Kimbrel, but there are a lot of free agents out there, and I thought some news would drop. A little bit has dropped, but not a lot. I was hoping for something along those lines. I didn't want to have a podcast that was primarily about the Super Bowl, and it's not because I thought the Super Bowl was boring. I mean, it wasn't wildly entertaining, but it was a good football game if you're into watching two coaches trying to figure each other out. So we're going to talk today. I got three topics that I really want to touch on. First is going to be the Super Bowl. I know a lot of you have probably heard stuff ad nauseum, analysis, etc. I'm going to try to be a little fresh with it. I won't go too in depth with it, but I do have some thoughts about it, about who the Patriots are. How many more years can they keep this up? Who Sean McVay is? What Sunday told us about Sean McVay? And how he'll handle defeat? Will it linger? Will he internalize it? And will he let it make him better? What happened with Todd Gurley? Guy only gets 10 carries in a game. There were some intriguing things for a Super Bowl that only had 16 points scored, 10 of which were in the fourth quarter. The second topic I want to touch on, there are some proposed changes to baseball that are being kicked around by the competition committee. Some have a better chance than others of actually going into effect this year. So we're going to touch on four major ones that I have some thoughts on. And then finally, we'll get to some local news, Nats and Wizards news. Wizards made a trade tonight. Earlier this week, we heard that John Wall is out for the year, most likely out for some, if not all of next year. So the Wiz traded Otto Porter today. The Nats brought back a familiar face on a one-year deal, kind of cementing their starting rotation. Bryce Harper met with a couple additional teams this week. There was a suggestion on Twitter that I thought was interesting about a guy that the Nats should consider, especially if Harper does not come back. So we'll touch on all of that. And yeah, it's going to be fun, man. So before we begin, I will let you guys know that we are affiliated with the DMV SportsNetwork.com. That's the DMV SportsNetwork.com. It's an up-and-coming sports DC sports website, and they have great written content. They cover all things DC sports, and they also have a ton of podcasts that they're a part of. We're a podcast that we kind of are affiliated with them. They blast our stuff out. We blast their stuff out. It's a great partnership. We are happy to be a part of their family and happy to have them as a part of our family. So check them out, dmvsportsnetwork.com. You can also check them out on Twitter, at @DMV_SN. You can also check us out on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. ITS About Time DC1. Let's get into the Super Bowl. The Patriots, 13-3 winners. They win their sixth Super Bowl in the last 18 years. They have been to 9 Super Bowls and have won 6 of them in the last 18 years. Really an amazing feat. A sentiment that I've seen a lot over the last few days, and I really do agree with it. As tired as I am of seeing the Patriots win Super Bowls and be in the Super Bowl, this is really a monumental achievement as a franchise. In the age of the salary cap and parity, reverse draft order, all of those things that go against being able to keep a team together, being able to build a dynasty, the Patriots have overcome all of that. Now, their two constants have been the greatest head coach of all time, Bill Belichick. I don't think anybody can doubt that anymore. The man has won 8 Super Bowls, 6 as a head coach. He's the greatest of all time. He ties Curly Lambeau for 6 titles. Curly Lambeau had NFL titles did not have Super Bowls, but because the Super Bowl didn't exist. But Bill Belichick is the greatest coach of all time because of what he's had to face. The salary cap, player turnover, and yes, he has had Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback of all time. Can't deny that. Guy's won six Super Bowls. At 40, what is he, 41? He continues to be one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. Tom Brady is the GOAT. Bill Belichick is the GOAT. They've had that at the head of their franchise for 20 years. Back to what, 2001, when Bledsoe got hurt, Brady came in, and then they made that run to their first Super Bowl. And you got to give the Krafts credit, the owners of the New England Patriots. They run the team beautifully. They've given pretty much anonymity to Bill Belichick. Anonymity is not the right word. They've given autonomy is the word I was looking for to Bill Belichick. He runs the team the way he sees fit. They take in strays. And all the way back to, remember, Corey Dillon, the running back that came from Cincinnati, had a bit of an attitude problem. He became a model citizen when he was with the New England Patriots. Randy Moss. This year, they brought in Josh Gordon. Now, Gordon didn't really, he worked out for a while, and then he had to take a leave of absence. But they churn out good players, not great players. But seven, 8 years, they've had Gronk, who's one of the best tight ends in recent memory. The Patriots, they're an amazing team. Let's talk about the Los Angeles Rams for a second before we get into the game. The Rams, they've got some roster decisions to make this year, this offseason. They had a lot of money invested in their team this year. They had some high-priced veterans. It'll be interesting to see what they do. I think that you're going to see them release some defensive players because they went for it this year. They made it all the way to the Super Bowl. Got to give Sean McVay a lot of credit. The way that he really turned this team around in just a couple of seasons, they ended up going 13-3 in the regular season, make it to their first Super Bowl in, I don't know, 15 years, I think is the number, right? With Kurt, when they went with Kurt Warner, or it might have been longer than that, actually. It might have been the 2001 Super Bowl. I haven't done my research on that. Anyway, a lot of credit to the Los Angeles Rams, but I said this last week, they didn't deserve to be there. The New Orleans Saints got screwed. The New Orleans Saints would have given the Patriots a better game. I think that Sean Payton and Drew Brees would have faced the New England Patriots defense better than Jared Goff and Sean McVay did. The city of New Orleans, they had some sort of March Sunday protesting the Super Bowl. The TV ratings in New Orleans for the Super Bowl were at an all-time low. They got screwed, and the NFL, Roger Goodell, refused to talk about it directly because they know how much of a black eye it is. I know that it's old news, it's 3 weeks old, but I just have to say, this game showed, in my opinion, the Rams did not belong there. The Saints should have been there. It would have been a better game if the Saints were there. I think it would have been more of a coin flip. In this game, it really just felt like the Rams were never in it. They were never really a threat on offense. So let's get into the game. Wasn't Brady's best game, statistically, but Tom Brady knows how to win football games. He was 21 of 35. He had one pick, which was on his, first pass of the game. From then on out, he was careful with the ball, 262 yards. Nothing that's going to blow you away. But he knew what he needed to do to win the game. He found Julian Edelman, and Edelman was a well-deserving MVP. Edelman had 10 catches for 141 yards on 12 targets, and Wade Phillips called a very good defense, only giving up 13 points. The defense did give up 407 yards to the Patriots. They let the Patriots hold onto the ball for 33 minutes plus. But the one question that I have is Wade Phillips, he figured out too late that Edelman needed to be doubled. They were so focused on taking Gronk away, and they didn't really succeed at that either. Gronk had six catches for 87 yards, but they were so focused that, and Edelman runs such crisp routes, and they talked about it, Romo talked about it during the game. He was impossible to cover, and really, in my opinion, Wade Phillips figured out too late that Edelman was a bigger threat, and that was really the story of the game. The first three quarters is the Patriots were eating up clock. They weren't scoring points, but they were eating up clock. They were keeping the Rams defense on the field. Bottom line, McVay was outcoached by Belichick. Belichick came out. He took away the Rams' strength, which is the inside run game, and forced Jared Goff to drop back and throw the ball. Jared Goff dropped back 38 times, only completed 19 passes. Todd Gurley only had 10 carries for 35 yards. C.J. Anderson, 7 carries for 22 yards. It was a masterful defensive performance, a masterful defensive game plan by the Patriots. And shockingly to me, Sean McVay never really adjusted, or it didn't appear that he adjusted enough to make an impact. If you look at the first eight drives, it was well documented during the game. First eight drives for the Rams resulted in a punt. The longest drive they had in their first eight drives was five plays. Their only scoring drive, it took them 10 plays to go 42 yards, and they kicked a field goal. The Patriots defense was suffocating all night. What the game felt like to me, I mean, I said it earlier, the Rams were never really in it. They never felt like a threat to move the football on offense. The Pats' offensive game plan really struck me as being conservative. It was ball control, hold on to the ball, wear the Rams' defense out. And it really was conservative because they had no fear of the Los Angeles Rams' offense. But also they knew, the Patriots did, that when they needed to turn it on, they could. Case in point, the Rams kick a field goal. Two drives later, the Pats have the best drive of the game for any team. The Pats go 69 yards on five plays and end it with a Sony Michel touchdown. The big play of that drive was the over-the-shoulder dime to Gronkowski by Brady that put them inside the two-yard line. And then the Pats ice the game with another long, beautiful drive, nine plays, 72 yards, ends in a field goal that iced the game, made it 13-3. The big game changer for me, Goff's interception deep in Patriots territory. His one big mistake of the game happened when they were driving, had a chance to tie the game. It was their one big momentum swing they had, and Goff kind of just threw it up. He was on his back foot. He was getting pressure. He threw it up, and the ball was picked off, and that was pretty much all she wrote after that. The Rams' defense at that point was gassed, and the Pats just ran over them. Nine plays, 72 yards, kicked a field goal to make it a two-score game and ice it. So was it an entertaining game? Not really, especially if you're just kind of a passive fan. You want to see points, you want to see exciting plays. There weren't many of those, if any. But it was interesting to see how now the oldest coach in NFL history to win a Super Bowl, Bill Belichick, how he was going to go against a young phenom, the 33-year-old Sean McVay. Belichick won the battle and the war. How does McVay recover from this? Well, I mean, a big addition they're going to get next year, Cooper Kupp will be back, was placed on the IR late in the season, and that completely altered the way that their offense ran. I think McVay will internalize this. I think he will learn from it. I don't think that this is going to derail McVay's career. I don't think that it's a blemish on his record because he's 33 years old, just turned 33 years old. He's going to learn from these things. He's got a very bright future. And if you're a Redskin fan, you're bummed that he didn't stay in Washington, to be completely honest. I don't think there was much they could have done to keep him because at the time, the Redskins were not going to fire Jay Gruden. I believe they were just coming off a division title. Was it a division title? It was either a division title or it was the year that Kirk Cousins threw the interception against the Giants in the final game of the season that cost the Redskins a chance at the playoffs. Either way, you got to feel bad if you're a Redskin fan. Sean McVay could have been with us. He's going to internalize this. They've got a lot of young weapons. They have a franchise quarterback in Jared Goff. I think because of his relationship with Sean McVay that he'll recover from this as well. I don't anticipate a giant Super Bowl hangover for the Los Angeles Rams. How great are the New England Patriots? It might be hyperbolic, but I don't think we'll ever see this, at least in my lifetime, the next, God willing, 50 plus years. I don't think we'll see another team like this in the NFL. I don't think you're going to see a team that's this dominant over this period of time with the way the game is. They want parity. They basically, everything that they do discourages dynasties. I don't think you're going to see another one like this again. You would need, again, the perfect combination, quarterback, head coach, and ownership group. All the stars would have to align like they did. The Patriots are they're an enigma. They really are. It's amazing. But also, they're not done. The Pats they're already the early favorites to win the Super Bowl again next year because their formula works. And they're in a division that they can easily win, which means that they're most likely going to cakewalk to another bye week, and then that all they have to do is win two games in the playoffs to get to the Super Bowl. And Brady knows how to do that. Belichick knows how to do that. So, unfortunately, I think we're going to see a lot of the same next year. I think you're going to see the Pats get a bye week in the playoffs, and I think you're probably going to see them in what would it be, their ninth or tenth consecutive AFC title game. They're an amazing thing to watch. It shows to me the Redskins in the last 20-plus years have not even been close to what the Patriots are. And there is no hope in sight for the Redskins. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. So it's discouraging to watch a team that's run this well, that plays this well. It's discouraging as a Redskin fan. It really shows that we're always going to be playing for, it's really just for the regular season, because we don't play the same sport as a team like the New England Patriots or the New Orleans Saints, the Kansas City Chiefs. We don't play the same, the Redskins don't play the same sport. They just don't. They don't have dynamic players. Their ownership group is a disaster. Their front office is a joke. We don't play the same sport. And I really am curious, and we'll have a lot of time to talk about this going into the Redskins offseason, going into the draft and free agency. Is there anything that they can do to spark the fan base? Right now I'm looking at it, I don't think there is. I don't even think drafting a quarterback would do it this go round. I don't think that a big trade of maybe getting Antonio Brown or something along those lines would do it. I just don't think that there's anything that's going to spark the fan base. The fan base is now at a point where it's going to be, I need to see you win before I'm going to get excited. Didn't mean to go down that path, but it's hard for me to watch football and not think about the Redskins and how different they are from a team like the New England Patriots or even the Rams now, Saints, like I said, Chiefs. So the Super Bowl's over. We're going into the offseason. Free agency will hit in about a month, month and a half. We'll talk about that as we get to it, what the Redskins should do, all that good stuff. But that's all for the NFL. It was a relatively fun season. I didn't really find the playoffs that intriguing. Championship games were great, especially the Kansas City, New England game. That was one of the best games I've ever seen, just going back and forth. But we'll see you again in August, football. But we'll talk free agency and draft coming up in the next month or so. All right, let's talk about some proposed changes to baseball. The big one I'm going to talk about, and we're going to start with, is the universal DH. It's being pitched. The consensus is it's not going to go through this year. They don't think that it would be fair, because teams have pretty much already built their teams. Nationally, teams have built their teams around the idea that pitchers are going to hit. So they're saying the change might come in 2021, 2022, but the players union is 100% on board because it creates more jobs. It extends careers. It basically creates another job on the team, which is either you can do the classic model, which is, you know, the David Ortiz, he's your DH 155 games a year, or you can do a more modern model, which is you kind of use it for matchups, you give guys days off in the field, and it's kind of a rotating fluid position where you can just rotate guys in and out. I think it's a thing that, before I get to my opinion on it, because it seems to be inevitable, it's something that the Nats could benefit from with a guy like Ryan Zimmerman, who I think would fit very well as a DH, be less wear and tear on his body. The guy is a natural born hitter. If that's all, he's a great defender, but you got to keep him off his feet. That's usually where he gets hurt, is playing defense, diving into stuff, running into walls, what have you. So it would be something that would benefit the Nats. That being said, I am 100% against it. Absolutely against it. I am a huge fan of National League Baseball. I love the way that National League Baseball plays out. Doesn't mean I don't like watching American League Baseball, but I love National League Baseball. I think there's more strategy to it. I think that you have to know how to use your bench. Your bench has to be deeper. And as frustrating as it is, when you're the team that, it makes some very tough decisions in the fifth, sixth, seventh inning. When you're a team that has maybe your, maybe not your ace, but a guy like, let's say Steven Strasburg's on the mound. It's a sixth inning, and he's batting second in the inning or third in the inning, and you're down a run. Let's say it's 1-0 or 2-1. You got to make a hard decision. How many pitches does he have left? Is it worth letting him pitch another inning or two and losing a potential opportunity to drive in a run? I think managers in the National League are better than managers in the American League because they have to balance more things. In the American League, it's pretty much bullpen. You don't have to worry about that. You can replace your pitcher whenever you want. You can run your pitcher out there and not have to worry about him hitting. But also, you could go a whole game and not use your bench. Or you might only need two bench guys, a power lefty, a power righty. And maybe use them in the eighth or ninth inning in a situation where you're trying to drive in runs and you're in the wrong part of your lineup. National League's a lot different. Most games, you're going to use the majority of your bench. You're using all 25 guys on your roster in the National League. I don't like it. And I want my pitchers batting. I want them involved in the game. I want them to have the opportunity to have an impact on the game on the offensive side. Let's look at some numbers real quick. And these numbers are not going to back me up. I've already looked them up. I know they're not going to back me up. But let's just look. The league average last year for position players in the National League, league average was .247 batting average and a .318 on base percentage. That was the league average for the National League. The league average for pitchers in the National League was a batting average of .117, so 130 points less, and an on-base percentage of .133, which was about 180 points less. The big number for me, which was not surprising but still a bit startling, the strikeout percentage for pitchers was 47%. 3,986 at-bats among all active pitchers in the National League last year, 1,875 strikeouts to only 133 walks. In 3,986 at-bats, there were only 18 home runs hit by 293 pitchers that qualified, 192 RBI. But I'll tell you something. You look at a guy, and I know the regular listeners of this podcast hate when I bring up Max Scherzer because I love the guy. He's what you should want everyone on your team to be like. He's a bulldog. The guy just plays his guts out every night, or every fifth day, I should say. Max had a 9.5, according to Baseball Reference, had a 9.5 WAR. In 2018, 8.8 of that WAR was pitching, but he had 0.7 or 0.7 WAR as a hitter, which is pretty impressive to me. Max last year, he hit .243, which was close to the league average. His on-base percentage was a little bit lower than the league average at .274, 6 RBI, but he made a difference. You remember the hits that he had, and he had the opportunity to have an impact on the games that he was a part of. I love that part of National League Baseball. I don't want to see it change. Matter of fact, if you're going to make a change And then Players Association would never allow this to happen, the Players Union, but you should get rid of the DH in the American League. But they'll never let that happen because it puts a lot of guys out of work. And I understand why the Players Union is pushing this. And I also understand why Major League Baseball wants to do it. I mean, the 15 teams in the National League, you got to imagine the majority of them are going to fight it, especially the old school teams are going to fight it because they like playing National League Baseball. But Major League Baseball perspective, you look at a guy like Max Scherzer, or, you know, let's keep it local with the Nationals, Patrick Corbin, you just gave $140 million to. You want to limit the risk with them. You don't want them to get hurt running bases, or, you know, get hit by a pitch or something along those lines. So that, and these are guys that you have gigantic contracts invested into. I can understand it from that perspective. I can understand it because when you look at a 113 batting average, 117 batting average, and an on-base percentage of 133, 47% strikeout percentage, it's almost an automatic out. 8.7 times out of 10, it's an out. On average, it's an out. I get all of that. I get it. And it's, you know, it's a part of the game that they'd like to eradicate. They think it'd be more exciting to have 9 hitters as opposed to 8 hitters and a pitcher. I would miss the strategy. I think that you would lose the use of your bench in the National League the way it's used now. The way you strategically set up your bench is actually really important in the National League. I don't want to see it go. It's going to go. They say it's inevitable, probably 2021, 2022. Most people are in favor of it. I completely understand their argument. But for me, I love National League Baseball. Leave it alone. But I'm going to have to get used to it at some point. It's kind of a bummer. My son will be 4 in a couple of months. He's probably never going to get to see the National. It's going to be a dinosaur when he is old enough to remember games. He's not going to know. I'm going to be one of those old guys that's like, well, you know, back in my day, pitchers hit. It's going to seem like it's going to seem ridiculous probably 10, 15 years from now. And that's a bummer to me. I don't want to see that, but it's going to happen. The next one that they've been proposing is that each, and this is the second big one, each pitcher is required to face 3 hitters. When I first heard this, I was against it, much like I'm against them outlawing the shift. Here's why originally I was against it. I was against it because my thing was it's an adaptation of the, or an evolution of the game, the way that bullpens are being used now, and eventually something new will come along. And it's just, you know, one side of the game, the defensive side, the pitching side changes, then the hitting adjusts, or the hitting changes, and then the pitching adjusts. And I said, why limit strategical moves by a manager, such as the shift, or in this case, if you bring a guy in from the bullpen, he's got to face at least 3 batters. Why do that? But I've thought about it a little bit more in the last couple of days, and I'm actually in favor of it. And here's why I'm in favor of it. I mean, I don't like that they are trying to regulate strategy, but I will be honest. And I am an avid baseball fan. I'm a diehard Nationals fan. I watch every game on TV. We've got a 21-game season ticket package. But when I'm at a game, and let's say it's like the middle of July, and it's 95 degrees outside and the sun is beating down, the last thing you want to see are 4 pitchers in the 7th inning. It's the last thing you want to see. It's ruined the postseason. I mean, the last postseason game the Nationals had was Game 5 against the Cubs in 2017. And that game was over, 4.5, almost 5 hours long. It was a 9-inning game because of the pitching changes. And it just, you know, I understand matchups. I get it. And this, you know, requiring to face 3 hitters, it's going to put some lefty specialists out of a job, or they're going to have to, you're just going to have to take a chance. But the one thing is, it will speed the pace of the game up. It'll speed the pace of the game up, and I'm actually in favor of it. It's something that I think will get used to pretty quickly. I think a lot of people will be in favor of it. And for me, the reason that really changed my mind is I think that it will bring more people to the game because the game will be faster paced, and I want baseball to be as popular as possible. So I think that it's a change that, while I don't like them regulating strategy, I think that it's a good idea. And I think that they're definitely going to do it. They might even do it as soon as, that's one of the ones that they might even make the change as soon as this year. Another one that they're thinking about could be implemented this year is a 20-second pitch clock. And the reason why the players union was vehemently against it last year, but the reason that they're starting to come over to Major League Baseball side is because it's been implemented in the minor leagues for years, and players coming out of the minor leagues are used to a pitch clock. This is the same thing. It'll help move the game along. I hate seeing a pitcher that, you know, the one pitcher that really sticks out to me, he's not active anymore, but was Josh Beckett. I remember watching a game with him, it's probably 7-8 years ago against the Nats, and it was a game that was in L.A., so it started at 10-10, and this is when the Nats weren't very good, but you start watching it, and Beckett was taking forever. I think they had him at like 45 or 50 seconds between each pitch, and it was horrible to watch. It was so slow. It was so boring. And not to mention the fact on the East Coast, it's 10-10 when you start. I'm already tired. They actually, if I remember correct, Mattingly was the manager at the time. He pulled Beckett because of how slow-paced he was and the defense was falling asleep. It was awful. And then I remember when the Nats played the Dodgers in the playoffs in 2016, Pedro Baez, man, was he slow to the plate. I mean, took his time. The pre-pitch routine every time, it just is nauseating. So I'm a big fan of this as well, 20-second pitch clock. I think players would adapt pretty quickly. I think they need to figure out, much like they needed to figure out with mound visits, how they're going to enforce it. What's going to happen if you exceed the pitch clock? Are you going to get warnings? And then if you exceed your warnings, then is it just a ball or is it a walk? Or how do you deal with it? Because you don't want to impact the outcome of the game too much by implementing this rule. But you also need to have a little bit of teeth so that people respect the rule. The final thing that I read that I wanted to bring up in regards to proposed changes to baseball. They are exploring that there's nothing set in stone right now, but they are exploring the possibility of lowering the mound again or potentially moving the mound further back. Now, the mound, for those of you that don't know, is 60 feet 6 inches away from home plate. It's been that way for generations. The reason they're trying to do this is because they want more offense. They think the pitchers have an unfair advantage or that they have exceeded the skill level of hitters. And last year, you're in the heart of the three outcomes, either a strikeout, a walk, or a home run. Strikeouts were, I think they were at an all-time high last year. They have been increasing every year. Batting average has been going down. Don't touch the mound, really. I mean, if you really want this to be an adjustment, the players, much like the shift, should learn to go the other way. You know, if you have a lefty up and there are four guys on the right side of the infield, slap the ball to left field. Get on base. You do that enough times, you're going to shift back. And I know the counterargument to that is, well, you know, you want a guy like, let's say, Bryce Harper. You want a guy like Bryce Harper hitting the ball, you know, into the gaps. Yeah, but if it's between him striking out or popping up or grounding out weakly to first base, if it's those options the majority of the time when he hit, 247 this year, or he can pick up an extra 5-6 hits a week by slapping the ball to left field or dropping a bunt down the third baseline, why not? It's the same premise here. Hitters should adjust. They will adjust. The problem here is that Major League Baseball got fat and happy in the late 90s, mid to late 90s into the 2000s during the steroid era with huge home run numbers, huge offensive numbers. And since they have legislated PEDs out of the sport, for the most part, offense has come down and pitching has become dominant again. You don't have many hitters, there are some, but you don't have many hitters that were like, let's say, a Tony Gwynn that was a contact hitter, put the ball in play. The Royals won a World Series being a contact team. They didn't strike out that much. That's kind of a thing of the past now. Teams should have to adjust. There shouldn't be regulations that make more offense. They did it in the NFL, and this is probably why Major League Baseball is considering it, because the NFL, they constantly are changing the rules of what a defensive back can do on to a wide receiver. When can they make contact, illegal contact. All of that stuff has created more offense in the NFL. And offense sells. People like to see touchdowns. People like to see home runs. They like to see offense. I'm old school. I like to see a pitcher's duel, a 2-1 game, a 1-0 game, what have you. But I also like to see, you know, a slugfest every once in a while. Sure. But don't make it where these games are just going to become like video game games where it's 15-13. I don't want to see that. And I love watching a good pitcher work. So don't ruin it by basically make them throw off a flat ground or pushing it back to 65 or 70 feet so that their velocity goes down and the ball's easier to hit. Come on, man. Like, just keep, don't change the game that much. I mean, if you want to speed the game up, great. If you want to add a universal DH because you want, that'll help generate more offense in the National League. I'm not happy about it, but go ahead. But when it comes to changing the mound, moving the mound back, you're just kneecapping pitchers, and I hate that. I love watching a good pitcher work. I hate that. So those are the proposed changes to baseball. The competition committee will be talking about it, I guess, when they meet next. And I think we're going to see a 20-second pitch clock this year. I think you'll probably see where a pitcher has to face three hitters minimum this year. The DH, moving the mound, other things, those are going to, I don't even think they're going to outlaw the shift this year. I don't think they're going to do that because that's just too controversial right now. I think a lot of teams would fight that. So those things will be put on the back burner. They'll be discussed at a later date. But look for the pitch clock and requiring pitchers to face a certain number of batters. All right, real quick water break. Let me take a little sip of this. All right. Before we go to topic three, which is local DC sports news, I am going to remind you guys again that we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. That is the DMVSportsNetwork.com, a local DC sports website covering all things DC sports. They also have great audio and written content. Check them out at DMV_SN. Listen to their other podcasts and follow them at on Twitter at DMV_SN. Follow us on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS, About Time DC1. Give us a follow. Subscribe to our podcast. Rate us. Send us a DM. Let us know something you'd like to talk about. We are always open to ideas. We love hearing from you guys. I say we. Josh hasn't been on in a few weeks. He said his schedule's just been crazy. But I'm going to keep this thing going at least. And I know Josh will be back soon. So we love hearing from you guys. We love you guys. We thank you guys for listening. So please subscribe, rate us, etc. So let's move on to topic three. That's Nats and Wizards news, local stuff. Let's start with the Nats. My number one in my heart, the Washington Nationals. So the Washington Nationals made a signing to, actually it was today, and I forgot to bring it up, so I'm going to type it into my computer. They signed Jeremy Hellickson to a one-year deal, bringing him back, a familiar face. Hellickson last year had a pretty decent year, considering Davey Martinez kind of limited him to two times through the lineup, but he only threw 91 1/3 innings. But he had a 3.45 ERA, started 19 games for the Nats, did get banged up towards the end of the year. But he was a nice fifth starter for the Nationals. He ate up some innings. And he's going to compete for that fifth spot. I think he is now the front runner in front of Eric Fetty and Joe Ross. But, and somebody said this on Twitter, I couldn't agree more. what last year taught us is that you can never have too much pitching depth. And now the Nationals have two guys in that fifth spot. Actually, if you want to include Henderson Alvarez, who signed a minor league deal, three guys with extensive major league experience between Hellickson, Ross, and Henderson Alvarez for that fifth spot. And then you have Eric Fetty, who has some major league experience for that fifth spot. The Nationals are going to have depth for the fifth spot in the rotation, potentially if they get an injury to one of their top four. They'll have some ammunition either in AAA or a long man in the bullpen that they can bring in. So I like the move a lot. I think it was mutually beneficial. I was surprised that he didn't get more, a little bit more interest out there. But the Nats rotation now, the reworked rotation for the Nationals, looks pretty good. I mean, you got to love the top three, Scherzer, Strasburg, Corbin. And then they added Anibal Sanchez and now bringing Hellickson back. It's a great 1-5. And if they stay healthy all year, or relatively healthy all year, you're going to get a good start every day from that starting rotation. They're going to give you a chance to win every day. I love the signing of Jeremy Hellickson. And just real quick, he was 5-3 last year, 3.45 ERA in 19 games started, had a pitch 91 and a third innings. Had 65 strikeouts in 91 and a third innings. Not bad for him. I mean, guys of finesse, got to work the corners kind of pitcher. But welcome back, Jeremy Hellickson. Him coming back is a lot like, it's a little different, but also very similar to Matt Adams coming back. Matt Adams absolutely loved it in D.C. last year. He wanted to come back. Apparently, Hellickson liked it here as well. He wanted to come back. It makes me happy that the Nationals are an organization, a destination for free agents, that free agents want to go to, that people want to re-sign with. Apparently, Anthony Rendon has intimated that he would really like to stay in Washington. It's a lot different than what goes on in Ashburn, Virginia with the Redskins, and that makes me very happy. I'm glad that Adam Jones. I'm glad that Jeremy Hellickson is back. I think the Nationals roster is rounding into great form. I think, and we'll talk about this next week as pitchers and catchers report. There are a couple under the radar guys that the Nats could sign to minor league deals or bring in as a potential bullpen piece that I'd like to see them go get. We'll talk about that next week. But welcome back, Jeremy Hellickson. Back on a one-year veteran minimum, he's got incentives that could hit up to about $4 million. Staying with the Nats, Bryce Harper this past week, over the last week plus, has now met with two additional teams, the San Diego Padres and the San Francisco Giants, two teams in the NL West. Let's start with the San Diego Padres. The one thing I found really interesting about the San Diego Padres for Bryce Harper is that it's possible for him to look at the Padres the way that Jason Worth looked at the Nats in 2011, as a team that is not a competitor or a contender now, but will be a contender in a year or two. 2011 was a tough year for Jason Worth, not a great year for the Nationals. I mean, it was a better year than most, but it was a year of growth. And then 2012, they surprised everybody and won the National League East and actually had the best record in the National League. The Padres have one of the best farm systems in baseball. And they have a lot of money that they can spend. They have Eric Hosmer. And they've got a very crowded outfield right now. Will Myers is out there. But bringing Harper in, it might accelerate their timetable a little bit. For Harper, I would like it if I'm him, because the media there is not going to kill him. San Diego is the Padres were the only game in town since the Chargers left. He would be a god there. He would be closer to home, his normal home in Las Vegas. He'd be a god there. Plus, the weather there is beautiful all the time. I don't know why anybody wouldn't want to go play in San Diego. But for Harper, the one thing that, if I were him, would give me pause is that stadium's gigantic. It's one of the biggest stadiums in baseball. His power numbers are going to go down. And that's his bread and butter, are hitting home runs. So that would give me some pause. It would also give me some pause. You're in the same division as the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have pretty much unlimited resources. They also draft well. They've got a great young team, so you're going to be in competition. So that would give me a little bit of pause. The Rockies continue to be competitive. So that would give me some pause. Let's talk. And the Padres apparently also are, if they were to offer Harper a mega contract, they have already decided that this is a business decision for them. It's not strictly a baseball decision. It's a business decision. They want to put butts in the seats. They want to generate some excitement. Harper would certainly do that. They would be kind of the out of left field team to come get him. I'd be happy for him if he signed there. I don't want him to sign in division. I don't want him to sign with the Phillies. Never wanted him to sign with the Braves. Don't want him. There's no chance he signs with the Mets, but I didn't want him to go there either. But I'd be happy for him if he landed in San Diego. I think that he could be a legend there. I had a conversation with Josh via text message. I think that Harper will end up in the Hall of Fame. I think with the amount of time he has left, he'll hit 550 or 600 home runs. I just think that's and that'll get him into the Hall of Fame. He might be a 260 career hitter, but he's going to have he's going to have at least 500 home runs if he stays healthy, 550, 600 home runs. I'd love for him to stay with the Nats, but the contract that he wants, I want the Nats to stay competitive. I've been over that before. I'd be happy with it for him if he landed in San Diego. Now you look at the Giants. The Giants came in. They met with Harper. Apparently Bruce Bochy was involved. Giants are a little bit of a different story. I'd be surprised. First of all, the Giants are an iconic franchise. Beautiful ballpark. Harper would mash there. Hitting balls into McCovey's Cove. And he'd be a stud there. Thing that worries me about them is they have a lot of money tied up in old players. They've got money tied up in Evan Longoria. They don't know what they're going to do about Madison Bumgarner. They got money tied up in Jeff Samardzija. I don't know how close San Francisco is to being competitive in the near future. Bryce Harper is not going to make them a contender. They'll still be third or fourth in that division, probably third, behind the Dodgers and the Rockies. San Francisco, I'm sure, would be a great place to live, great ballpark to play in. Again, would be close to his hometown. But again, if he's about winning, I'd be surprised if he went there, because they are in need of a teardown and a rebuild. And I don't know how serious they are. I don't know if they're just doing their due diligence. But if I'm Harper, I probably don't want to go to the Giants. The Padres, are surprisingly, would be more attractive. But again, we're at that thing with Harper where how many people are legitimately interested and are legitimately interested at the terms that he wants? John Heyman came out this past week and said that really the front runners for Harper continue to be White Sox, Phillies, are people that are interested, Nats, and there are other teams that would engage with Harper if he was willing to take a shorter deal, 3 or 4 years. I can't see Harper taking a 3 or 4 year deal when for the last 8 years they've been pointed at this free agency period and he was going to get the biggest contract of all time. It's fascinating. Some of you guys might be tired of me talking about Bryce Harper. I think it's fascinating, especially because he's a Nat. He's still a National until he signs somewhere else. And like I said last week, I think now is the time for the Nationals to re-engage with Bryce. I think Bryce, I don't want to say he's desperate, but I think he's more willing to negotiate now. I think he'd be willing to do a team-friendly contract that on paper made him look good, but technically also helped the team. I think the Nationals should do it. I think they should at least explore it, and they have ways that they can trim salary this year, trading Adam Eaton, restructuring Ryan Zimmerman's contract. There are things that they can do. So, I don't know, man. With what? We're 7 days away from pitchers and catchers reporting. By the time you guys listen to this, it'll be 6 days or less. I can't believe Harper hasn't signed Machado, Kimbrel, Keuchel. Something that was suggested on Twitter about another player that remains unsigned. Somebody said if the Nats don't bring Harper back, it would be a pretty cool move to bring Adam Jones in as kind of a swing outfielder, your third, fourth outfielder. I love that idea. I really do. Jones last year hit 281 in 580 at bats. He had 15 homers and only a 313 on base percentage in Baltimore. He's always had a lot of power. Baltimore is a great ballpark to hit home runs in. One thing was a little bit, his WAR last year was only 0.2. His last big WAR season, 2015, he had a 3.4. He had a three-year stretch, 12, 13, and 14, where he had an over 4 WAR. But he's still a very productive player. He's only 33 years old. Still an above-average defender. Still can he stole 7 bases last year, drove in runs. I think he'd be a great fit. I think he wants to start every day. Nationals can't offer him that. But if he's willing to sign a one-year deal and come in, because if anything, over the last few years that we've been taught, the Nationals need outfield. I mean, they have outfield depth in the system. You've got Andrew Stevenson and Michael A. Taylor. But if you brought in Adam Jones, I mean, then you really, your top four outfielders are legit. And Adam Eaton, I think he'll be able to play every day this year, but you're still probably going to want to spell him. And you're going to want to give Robles and Soto days off. I think Jones would be a great addition. But it depends on how much money they'd have to give him. I don't know if they have enough money to do that. Because if he's going to sign a one-year deal, he's going to want a deal similar to what Dozier signed, like a $9 million. I don't know if the Nats have that. I mean, they certainly have it, but I don't know if they want to go that far above the luxury tax threshold. And if they are going to go that high above the luxury tax threshold, why not just bring Harper back? All right, let's move on to the Wizards before we close this thing out. News broke a couple of days ago that John Wall is now definitely out for the year. He ruptured his Achilles a couple of days ago. He was having surgery in December to avoid tearing his Achilles, and then he slipped in his house and tore his Achilles. So he is definitely out the rest of this season. The odds are, they say that it's anywhere from an 11 to 15 month recovery, and that's just till he can resume basketball activities. Odds are he misses most of, if not the entire season next year. Relatively big blow, considering he's making $40-plus million over the next 4 years. It's a lot of money tied up in a guy who's not going to play. Your franchise guy, he will most likely miss all of next season. And tonight, the Wizards traded Otto Porter to the Bulls for Bobby Portis and Jabari Parker. It's definitely a salary dump. They're getting rid of Otto's max contract. And they're bringing on two guys who combine for about 30 points a game. And so it's an even trade, I think. The Bulls are getting themselves a young guy who's under contract, but the Wizards are getting rid of a max contract. So the question now is Bradley Beal next? It could have happened while I was recording. I haven't looked at the Twitter machine. But is Bradley Beal next? I said this, I don't know if it was last week or 2 weeks ago, the Wizards need to stop winning games. They just do. They should be shooting for the lottery. This is going to be one of the most talent-rich lotteries in recent memory. Not just Zion Williamson. I'm talking about, there are guys probably 1 through 4 that could be franchise changers. The Wizards should be shooting for that. They're currently the 11th seed in the Eastern Conference. There's no reason that they should be thinking, oh, maybe we can win a playoff series. Screw that, man. I don't like the term tank. I don't like the idea of losing games on purpose. All right, so you're not losing them on purpose, but maybe trade guys and put yourself in a position to play some young guys. Like, you know, and if you lose games, so what? It's amazing to me, and I saw somebody comment on this earlier, a couple days ago, that you could have Ted Leonsis, who, as owner of the Capitals, is one of the best owners in all professional sports. The way he runs the team, just the franchise in general, they put out Actually, I think it was Dom from the Dom and Thunder show on DMV Sports Network that said this, that they put out perennial contenders, the Capitals do. And then on the other side of the coin, Leontes, as owner of the Wizards, just has this really poorly run franchise. He refuses to get rid of Ernie Grunfeld. And it's just kind of the same old song and dance every year. The Wizards are either mediocre or they're kind of bad. It's just this year they're kind of bad to almost really bad. They need something to change their fortunes. The only way to do that is to get into the lottery. So, all in for Zion Williamson. That's my philosophy. You're not going to do any damage in the playoffs. You don't get points, franchise points or whatever, for making the playoff. Doesn't do anything. If you're not a contender to win the title, and the Wizards are not, then you should be looking for ways to get better. And one of the ways to get better is to draft one of the franchise-changing players, preferably for me. I'm a huge fan of Zion Williamson. All right. Will they trade Beal? I don't think they will. I think that Josh said it best. He texted me earlier today, tonight, after the Porter trade. He said everything the Wizards do is half-assed. So they'll trade Otto, and then they'll think that they've retooled their team and that they can make a run for the eighth seed. And they'll probably get to the eighth seed, and then they'll knock themselves out of lottery contention because, you know, DC Sports, man. It's what we do. DC Sports. That's all I've got for tonight. Appreciate you guys listening. Again, we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. They can be located on Twitter at DMV_SN. Check them out. Read the articles. They've got some great stuff. Their website's being revamped. Check out the podcast that they blast out. Again, they have a Wizards podcast. They have a Nats podcast, Caps podcast. I mean, just anything. As a DC sports fan, anything that you could possibly want, they've got it for you. Follow us on Twitter. It's About Time, DC1. ITS, About Time, DC1. And, give us a follow. Subscribe to our podcast. Rate us. Let us know what you think. Always happy to hear from you guys. I appreciate you guys listening. And we will talk to you guys next week.